Thank you for listening to this sermon recorded at the Lost River Church of Christ. For more information, check out our website at lostriverchurch.org or call us at 270-843-3163. We consider it an honor to share the good news of Jesus Christ with you completely free of charge. Have a great day and enjoy the sermon.
All right, well, it's about 9 o'clock. I think everybody's getting settled in. Appreciate everybody being here this morning. See some visitors out in the audience. We're especially glad you're here. Got some from way out west and then a few from way out east over in Tompkinsville. Glad to see you guys here this morning. We'll begin this morning with a word of prayer. I know we've got several we need to remember this morning. Of course, want to keep the Holloway family in our prayers. They lost Brother Bobby. And I think Jennifer, she flies out today. Is that correct? To head out west. We'll remember her. Does anybody have anybody else that we need to make mention of this morning? All right, if not, let's go to God in prayer and get started. Our Heavenly Father, we're grateful for this day and everything that you blessed us with. We're grateful for this day that we have to come together with those of like faith and to worship you. And we pray that we'll do so in a way that's well-pleasing in your sight. We pray this morning that you'll specifically bless us in this class. Help us to see what you've revealed to us through the book of Genesis and to see how you revealed your power and your will and your might to us. We pray that we'll take that and use it to become better servants of yours and better examples to those around us. Pray that you'll be with those who are sick or continue to be mindful of Jennifer. Pray that you'll give her safe travels as she heads to see her doctors this week. Pray that you'll help them to find some answers and find something that can help her to continue to recover. I pray that you'll watch over the Holloways as they grieve. Pray that you'll comfort them and help us to do the same. Forgive us for our sins and bless our class this morning. That's our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. All right, so we're on class number 11, clicking right along through our study of the book of Genesis. We're on chapters 10 and 11 this morning. One scheduling note I'll make before we get going. I'm actually going to have to be out of town on Wednesday, so if you're looking at your schedule, I won't be here Wednesday. So if you're planning on skipping, you can go ahead and come, so I won't be here. But Brother Cooks volunteered to fill in for me. We're just going to swap Wednesday, so skip next Wednesday if you're trying to skip my next class. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, that's the case. Y'all may have to help me out a little bit this morning. You can probably already tell my voice isn't its strongest this morning, so if you need me to speak up, raise your hand and I'll do that. All right, class number 11, Genesis 10 through 11. So at this point, we've talked about creation. You know, we've talked about Cain and Abel, we've talked about the flood, and all these big stories. We've got a little bit of a interesting hodgepodge of material this morning. We've got a lot of small snippets of information. We've got quite a bit of genealogy this morning, everybody's favorite, right? And then we've got a couple of brief stories included as well, a couple stories that we know well, but they are fairly short. So we're going to go through some of this genealogy a little bit more extensively than I guess I had originally planned on. But especially in chapter 10, where most of it is found, there's more there than I think that I had originally realized. I know I'm probably not the only one that sometimes when I get to the genealogy chapter, I just flip the page over and, you know, you're starting to read the stories again. But especially here in chapter 10, we're going to see a lot about how God fills the earth, how God sort of sets up the nations that surround where he, of course, created the world and where they all dispersed. From Mount Ararat and from Babel. So we're going to see that. There are a lot more recognizable names in Genesis chapter 10 than I think that I had realized before. So that was an interesting piece of this study for me. So I appreciate everybody being here, and that's what we'll do this morning. So just some objectives, a few things for us to try to do this morning if I can get this thing to work. So like I said, we just want to see how God filled the earth after the flood. God told man that he wanted him to rule the earth and subdue it, to fill it, all the way back in chapter 1, and we're going to see kind of how that comes to fruition a little bit better here in chapter 10 and 11. Of course, when we get to chapter 11, we're going to talk about the Tower of Babel. That's the narrative piece of this text that we're going to go through a little bit more. That may be where we spend the majority of our time. And so we could take a lot of lessons from that story, but I do think one of them is just to see the danger in seeking a worldly name out of arrogance. I think that's really where those at the Tower of Babel got it wrong. They tried to make a name for themselves. You know, they wanted to build themselves up. They wanted to have some renown in and of themselves outside of God. And that's not a new problem even in the book of Genesis, right? This rebellion against God, we don't need you. That happens already for a second time here in Genesis chapter 11. We'll talk about that a little bit as well. And then at the very end of chapter 11, Scott said he had a new one of these, and I wish we had it this morning. We're just going to see how God's plan through Abraham begins. We'll see these last few verses of chapter 11 will be introduced to Abraham, of course, really the key figure in the book of Genesis. We'll see him be introduced to his family, and he'll get started on his journey towards Canaan. Of course, won't get there. We'll just go ahead and introduce ourselves to Abraham a little bit and start to see how that story unfolds. All right, so that's what we're going to do this morning. Does anybody have anything they'd like to add by way of introduction? All right, Genesis chapter 10. So, that's going to get frustrating. All right, so Genesis chapter 10. So, from the beginning, we know that God created one man and one woman. He made made Adam and Eve. But then when he makes the decision to wipe out the earth, he leaves one bloodline, right? He leaves Noah and his family. So from then on, everybody is going to be through Noah. So in a sense, Noah is kind of a second patriarch, right? As much as we're all from Adam, we all come from Noah in the same way. So that's really what chapter 10 tells us. Moses tells us all about the sons of Noah and what all they did, where all they went, and the type of things that they got involved in shortly after the flood. And it's kind of an illustration of God's complete filling of the earth. So to this point, God's creation had mankind had sort of stayed local. They had stayed together. You know, Adam and Eve and his family, they had sort of stayed together, with the exception of Cain going off into the land of Nod. But particularly after the flood, for a few generations, everybody kind of stayed close. And that's why the Tower of Babel happened. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. But as a few generations go by, they start to not only fill the earth just by numbers, by quantity, you know, just increasing the population of the earth, they start to fill it geographically. You know, they start to spread out throughout the world, have been filling these different nations. And that's what we're going to see here in Genesis chapter 10. Just an interesting point that we can bring out as we get started, though. And there's a theme of sevens here in Genesis chapter 10. What does seven indicate in the Bible? Completeness, right? And so that's why we talk about this complete filling of the earth. I don't know how much of this is intentional. I think sometimes we can read into it a little bit more, but I did think it was worth mentioning. So Japheth, of course, is one of the sons of Noah. It lists seven sons and seven grandsons, right? Ham's lists seven descendants of Cush, seven cities, and Egypt's seven sons. And then there are 70 total nations in this whole chapter from Noah's sons. I don't know, there might be a little bit more that we can just discount to say that that's total coincidence. I don't know how much to make of that. But again, it's kind of God's complete filling of the earth that he makes happen here in Genesis chapter 10, right after the flood. All right, so these are kind of the bookend verses of Genesis chapter 10, kind of to summarize it on either end. It says, this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And sons were born to them after the flood. And then in verse 32 it says, these were the families of the sons of Noah according to their generations and their nations. And from these the nations were divided on the earth after the flood. So pay careful attention to that last verse, the nations were divided. To this point, what's kind of been true about the nations that God has created? They've kind of all lived together, right? They're all family, right? And they've kind of all lived together in the same local area. And that's not going to be the case very, very soon. All right, so we can go ahead and go through some of these. The sons of Japheth. Well, actually, we can go and look at this map. So I don't know how well you all can see this. That triangle, I hope you all can see that. That's where Mount Ararat was, and what was significant about Mount Ararat? Right, it's where the Ark rests. Does anybody know what modern-day country that's in? Turkey, very good. Wow. It's actually a volcano. I don't know if anybody knew that. It's a good thing that the Ark didn't sit there for too long. It could have ended kind of explosively. And so then from Mount Ararat, they seem to have wandered south a little bit, down to Shinar, to the Tower of Babel. And from there is where Noah's sons kind of begin to dissipate. I don't know if you can read that text. Japheth is up to the north in Europe. Shem is over to the east in Asia. And then Ham's down in Africa. So I assume that the majority of us are from Japheth. I don't know if we can say that for sure, but I'd say most of us have European background, so yeah, if that's something that interests you. So we start in verse 2 with the sons. Man, that's frustrating. Sons of Japheth. The sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tirus. You're probably thinking, why in the world are we reading this? Why are we reading these names that don't make any sense? Do any of those names sound slightly familiar? Somebody say something? Right. So where do we hear about Magog? Yeah, Gog and Magog. Does anybody remember? It's in Ezekiel 38 and Revelation chapter 20. Some pretty detailed prophecy that I don't pretend to understand, and I think some people who do pretend to understand it may be overstating their knowledge a little bit, but we'll hear about those some more. What about Madai? Does that sound like a nation that interacts with the Israelites at any point, with the children of Israel? Give you a hint. What if you change that first A to an E? King Darius. Yeah, the Medes, right? So what's significant about the Medes? When do they come on the scene? Right, and they take over Babylon after the Judeans are taken into captivity there. Right, so they come from this guy. That's where they came from. What else? This Javan character, he is the father of the Greeks. Now, he went into Macedonia. I may just need to punt with this thing. It's not going to work. And so the Greeks came through Javan. So already two very critical nations throughout the Old Testament history and into the intertestamental period come from these two individuals that we read about here in Genesis chapter 10, there in verse 2. So talk about the Medes. They take over Babylon. Then who comes and takes over the Medes later? The Persians, right? And then the Medes and the Persians kind of reigned together for a little while, but who came after that? Greeks, right? Alexander the Great, if you're into Daniel, the big horn, right, that comes in and wipes out the Medes and the Persians. Very good. All right, so we'll go on into verse 6 and talk about the sons of Ham, unless somebody else had something on that. All right, the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. The sons of Cush were Seba, Havilah, Sabtai, Raamah, and Sabtica. Does anybody see any names there that might be familiar? All right, Canaan's the obvious one, right? So we know all about Canaan. But what about, is anybody reading from a different translation this morning? They might have a different word for that second name, Mizraim. Some translations give us a name there that's a lot more recognizable to us. Egypt, yeah. So that's the Hebrew name for Egypt. So we know all about them. That's where he went. He went down to the south and ruled in that area. And then, of course, the Canaanites as well. So Cush, he became Ethiopia and Nubia, down into Africa as well. Mizraim's Hebrew name for Egypt, we said that. And then from Canaan. So what about all those nations that the Israelites find themselves fighting against all throughout the books of Kings and Chronicles? You know, the Jebusites, Amorites, Hivites, Tyre and Sidon, all these different nations, they come from the sons of Ham. So we can kind of trace these all the way back to the very beginning. All right, some city builders. All right, so I want to stop on this just for a second. Let's read verses 10 through 11. I don't think I have these on the slides. And the beginning of, let's back up to verse 8. Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. In the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh, in the land of Shinar. From that land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, I'm probably butchering these, Kala. All right. So first of all, I don't know if we have any expecting mothers in here expecting little boys, but there are lots of good names to choose from here in this chapter. Nimrod, I think, might be my personal favorite. So if anybody's interested in that. So Nimrod builds all these cities. Now he builds seven, I think, there again, as part of this theme of sevens. But there are two that he builds that are going to have special significance. One of them that he builds is Nineveh. Now, what's Nineveh the capital of? Right? And then he builds Babel in the land of Shinar. Now, do we ever hear those two names kind of put together, at least something that sounds a whole lot like Babel coupled with Shinar? What about Daniel chapter 1? All right, so who takes the Judeans captive in Daniel 1? The Babylonians, right? Not same thing, just slightly different pronunciation. The Babylon is Babel. And I tell you what, just turn over to Daniel 1 and verse 2. We'll just see that. Instead of me trying to explain it. I'm just going to start in verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. So again, Shinar seems to refer to Babylonia, this region around Babylon. So what has Nimrod built, these two cities that are the capitals of what two nations? The two nations that did what? What does Assyria and Babylon have in common? They took the children of God into captivity. Israel first, of course, and I get my numbers, 722 B.C., right? And then about 600, the Judeans are carried into Babylon. So Nimrod, despite his strange name, did some pretty significant things in this time. All right, anything else on the sons of Ham? I promise we have some stories to get to here in just a minute, but bear with me. All right, the sons of Shem. Sons of Shem were Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. So what's the most significant thing typically that we think of with Shem? Who is his most famous heir? I would say Abraham would be number two. Thinking several generations down. Well, you're right. From a physical, earthly perspective, yes. But it's the line of Christ is the point that I'm trying to get at. At Luke chapter 3, the genealogy in Luke 3 is kind of interesting because it goes backwards. I don't know if anybody's ever looked through that. You know, instead of going Adam begat so-and-so, begat so-and-so, it starts at the bottom. It says Christ and then goes all the way up, all the way back to Adam, the Son of God. And so this is the Semitic line, the Jewish line, right, of the sons of Abraham and all of his descendants. So what nations might come from him? Well, do you remember how Lot begat Moab and Ammon? Does anybody remember how those nations came to be? Right. Lot committed in a sinful way with his two daughters, and they gave birth to Moab and Ammon. And that's where those nations that were a thorn in the side for the Israelites for a long time came from their own blood. Does anybody know who Keturah is? We're going to talk about her in just a few chapters. Right, after Sarah. So Abraham wasn't done having children after Sarah, actually. And so Midian. Now, who lived in Midian? Right, that's right. The middle 40 years of his life is where Moses lived. Very good. And then, of course, Ishmael, now the oldest son of Abraham that he had through Hagar. That comes, as we'd call him today, the Arabs. From Esau, of course, have the Edomites that lived in that region of the world. And then, of course, the most important from Jacob, we have the Israelites. Very good. All right, so I think that's about all I have to say from this chapter 10 genealogy. Well, I do have one last thing to point out. Does anybody have anything else on the sons of Shem? I know this can be a little dry. All right, so this is where we're going to start to get into the action of the story. So we're going to start to get into the narrative just a little bit. So in Genesis 10 and verse 25 says, to Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. So what does that mean, the earth was divided in his days? Well, if we're just reading to this point, we don't know, right? Through Genesis chapter 10, we don't know what exactly he's talking about, but I think we're going to get a pretty significant clue in just a few verses. So Peleg is five generations after the flood. Scholars kind of debate whether it's 100 years. It's most likely at least 100 years after the flood happened that he lived. Probably a little bit longer, but not a terribly long period of time. Five generations, but we're starting to get into this period where people are living a lot shorter lives. So a generation doesn't take nearly as long as it used to. So we're probably only about 100 years after the flood. And so I'm going to suggest to you that this earth was divided is probably a reference, if I can get it to pull up, likely a reference to the Tower of Babel in chapter 11, this scattering that we're going to see here in just a minute. And so five generations since Noah, like we said. At the very least, it seems like there is a significant world-changing event in the life of Peleg. I don't know how the earth dividing would not be a significant thing, and that seems to happen in his life, which would be likely around 2200 B.C. The flood happened anywhere from 2300 to 25, depending on how you date some things. So we're probably looking at about 2200 years before Christ when all this is going down. All right, so y'all have had enough of that. Let's get into some stories. Now, the Tower of Babel, this is what everybody knows a little bit better, and hopefully we can have some engaging conversation. It says, now the whole earth had one language and one speech, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. So we already said that the land of Shinar refers to what we know later on in the Old Testament as Babylon. So what language, so it says they all had one language and one speech. What language do you think they're speaking? Maybe. I don't know. What does anybody else think? I don't think we do. Well, so what are the things we do know? We know that from the very beginning, from day one, Adam and God had a language that they both understood, that they could speak back and forth. Of course, God's going to understand it, but that Adam could understand in both directions how to communicate with God. And it doesn't seem like to this point there's been anything that would upset that. I don't really seem to have any belief that they would have come up with some new language since then, or that the flood would have had any impact on their ability to speak to one another. So I assume that they're still speaking Adam's language, whatever that was. Whatever the language that God spoke with Adam, and that's the language they're continuing to speak. But, well, we'll get to that in just a moment. As we already said, Shinar refers to Babylon. All right, so the journey from the east, they found the plain, and they dwell there together. So all of these, everyone who is still living after the flood, as they begin to repopulate, again, about five generations, so we're probably starting to have quite a few more people, but they all seem to be living together there in the land of Shinar. That's going to be very important. They're all dwelling in relatively close proximity. And that's significant because of what they say next. Then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad among the face of the earth. So what do they decide to do? Decide to build a tower, but not just a tower. Right. Right, very good. So he said that build the tower to kind of keep everybody close together, and I think that's exactly right. But they're going to build a tower in a city, right? It's not just a standalone tower. They're going to build kind of some roots, and it's something that can keep them there together. So I know when I was growing up and I learned this story in Bible class, what's kind of the reason that we always hear about why the tower was built? They want to get up there and reach God. And I don't know. I guess we can look at that and sort of see that, but I'm not 100% sure that's exactly what they were trying to do, specifically about what they say, and also because of something we talked about a few classes ago. Do you remember, I think it was the first class I taught, when we went through the creation account, and we talked about that word heavens that's used several times throughout Genesis chapter 1. We talked about how it's kind of used in three different ways. Does anybody remember what those were? The word heavens. So on one level, it just kind of refers to the sky, right? The birds fly in the heavens and the firmament between the waters below and the waters beneath. And then where does God put the sun, the moon, and the stars? In the firmament, in the heavens. I don't think those are the same thing. And then what's, of course, the most common understanding of the word heaven? God's dwelling place, right? So these three things can't all be the same. So to this point in Genesis, we haven't heard anybody use heavens to refer to God's dwelling place yet. Okay, that it has not been a concept at all. That's really more of a New Testament concept, really, when Jesus says, glorify your Father in heaven, things like that. So I'm not sure that they're really trying to physically get to God. I'm not sure that's really the idea. I think they're just trying to build it way up into the sky. Because what are they trying to do? What does it say there in verse 4? Make a name for ourselves, right? We're trying to be somebody. We want to have some renown. We want to have some status. We want to have some significance. And if we build this thing way up in the sky, that'll do that for us. I think that's really their goal more so than to physically get up there and reach God. Does anybody have any thoughts on that? Feel free to push back. Right. To your point, so God's given them the command to scatter and to fill the earth. And what's their fear at the end of verse 4? Let's do this so we're not scattered. So essentially, let's do this so we don't fulfill what God has asked us to do. So getting a little behind on my slides here. Why was the tower built? So building this tower is going to give them renown and unity, right? It's going to keep them together, and it's going to give them a name, and that seemed to be what they're looking for. So the population is clearly flourishing. They're doing well. You know, you can't start building cities, you can't start building towers unless you're eating well, unless your society is kind of flourishing. So within five generations after the flood, they're setting up some roots, and they're doing pretty well. But what happened the last time man was doing well back in the garden? They forgot about God in a second. So as I was preparing for this, I came across something that I thought was pretty interesting that, you know, if the flood was a new creation, if the flood was kind of round two of the creation, the Tower of Babel is kind of round two of the Tree of Knowledge. You know, we are doing well because of what God's given us, but we're going to use that as a reason to trust in ourselves and to shun Him and to do things the way we want to rather than what He's commanded us to do, and it's going to end up producing disastrous results yet again. All right, anything else on those couple of verses? Okay, you're thinking maybe that there was some sort of religious significance to the tower and they had something there that they worshiped. Possibly. I don't know how much indication we have. I do know that a lot of folks seem to think that this tower was what's commonly referred to as a ziggurat, right? These ancient towers that were used as objects of worship. So maybe so. I don't know if we have enough there to say that definitively, but possible. Sure. Anybody else? Very good. Go ahead, Mr. Gibson.
Human nature begins with getting us Legos and new clothes and whatever they do, stacking on the side of the world. I think this is part of mankind to build things that are tall. And like I said, there's some people there trying to give themselves a surround, a single purpose, and this unifying effort to do this. So it all fits into the nature of man, and it helps us to see part of our nature that can be positive.
Brother Gibson just said that it's kind of in all of our nature to try to build something up, even as kids. We know we're trying to build things high and make something of ourselves, so it kind of provides some insight in the way we often think of ourselves. Very good.
They weren't really trying to impress anybody else around them. It was just them. But to build something for posterity, you know, we don't want to be forgotten. They don't want to do like everybody does, which is die and the next generation comes along. They want to put something up there that they will be remembered by.
Right. I think that's an excellent point. There's nobody else to show off to, right? It's just us. So that's very good to leave a legacy. And that's what we all want, too. Very good.
I see why they want to stay together, too, because the safety.
Mm-hmm. And they were starting to realize what all they could do when they stayed together. You know, they were doing so well. It's like, man, if we keep this going, there's no telling what we can do. And I think that's what we're going to see in these next few verses. And because God begins to see that as well. It said, but the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language. And this is what they begin to do. Now nothing they propose to do will be withheld from them. So that phrase there at the beginning of the verse, but the Lord came down. That's a little bit humorous to me. They're trying to build this grand tower, you know, to reach up to the heavens. And then what does God say? He still has to come down to see it, right? They just have no hope of getting anywhere near him. But God starts to understand the way they're thinking pretty quickly. He said he understands that their unity, their togetherness, and all this flourishing they're doing because they're working together so well, it's made them believe that they can do just about anything they want. They think that just whatever they decide to do, because they've got the resources, they've got the people, they've got the whatever it is, that they can go and make it happen. Now, does that mean that that's true? I mean, do they have some sort of superhuman ability that anything that they want to do will be? I don't think that's what God's saying at all. It's not like they've got these, you know, endless ability to do anything that they want. But he understands that if there's something they want, they're going to try it. And whether it's what he wants or not, whether it's his will for them or not, they're going to try to do those things because they just have this attitude that they can because they're succeeding so well to this point. And they believe that they can do it again without God's help, which is the most important aspect of it. All right. So then what happens? How does God choose to address the problem? He says, come, let us go down, and they're confused their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. A few things on this. So we see this plural us used again by God. We saw that back in Genesis chapter 1, right, where God is speaking, let us make man in our image. We see that again here in chapter 11. Also, it kind of makes an interesting parallel with back in verse, I guess it's 3 and 4, when the people are saying, come, let us do this. Come, let us go and make bricks. Let us build this tower. And then God says, now let us go down and confuse their languages. I don't know. I think there's probably some interesting parallel there. And so God confuses their language, makes it where they can't understand each other. Am I the only one that's ever kind of understand what the execution of this looked like? You know, did it happen instantly, or, you know, were two people just having a conversation, and then the next thing you know, one of them's speaking Portuguese and the one of them's speaking French? I don't know. It could potentially be some pretty funny things happen here. I think there's been some comedians do some stuff on that would be pretty interesting. So, and I don't know if any of you have ever had to work with somebody or, you know, be in any kind of close relationship with somebody where there's a significant language barrier. But it makes it about 1,000 times harder, doesn't it? I mean, just very simple things that you and I can get done in 10 seconds because we understand each other take a very, very long time for somebody that doesn't. And especially if you're doing something like construction, you know, where things need to be done detailed, they need to be done right, they need to be done precisely. If we don't understand each other, we're going to be in trouble. Of course, this is the day before AutoCAD blueprints and these type of things that we can just look at and everybody can understand. So this language barrier was undoubtedly the dynamite that just blew this project all to pieces. And so what might that language confusion do? So to this point, other than halting the work, to this point, we've been motivated to stay together because we're the same. We work together. We understand each other. We get things done. But now, if some of us speak this language, some of us speak that language, some of us speak a different language, what does that make us kind of want to do? Birds of a feather flock together, right? You know, those of us who understand each other, we'll go over here. These others, we'll live in this area. And that's exactly what happens. So it kind of provides the motivation finally. They've been incentivized to this point to stay close, to live together and to work. But now they kind of have the opposite motivation to go and to spread throughout the world, which is what God's plan was from the very beginning. And so therefore, its name is called Babel, because the Lord there confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over all the face of the earth. Of course, that word Babel, we have an English equivalent of that, spelled a little bit differently, just conversation that doesn't make sense. Of course, that's exactly what happened here. All right, got about 10 minutes left, I think. Anything else on that story before we talk about Abraham just a little bit before we wrap up. Yeah. It would be if everybody could communicate that clearly. That would be interesting. Another thing I meant to point out too that I forgot about. Do you think anybody got to continue speaking the original language? You know, that I don't know. I've kind of wondered that before too. Not that it really matters, but did anybody get to be an original that spoke the? I've kind of tend to believe that maybe not. Maybe that language that God spoke with Adam is gone forever after Babel, but. Don't guess it matters a whole lot. All right, so now the big character in the book of Genesis, talk about Abram just for a minute. It says that Nahor lived 29 years and begot Terah. After he begot Terah, Nahor lived 119 years and begot sons and daughters. Now Terah lived 70 years and begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. All right, so the first thing that kind of jumps out to me about those few verses is, so back in Genesis 1, we go through these genealogies, or earlier in the book, Genesis 5 maybe, it was Adam lived 130 years and then begat Seth, and then he lived 800 more years and then he died, right? A little bit different here in Genesis chapter 11, here after the flood. Nahor only lives 29 years and has a son, and then he lives 119 years total. So the lifespan of man has definitely shortened here after the flood, as God said that it would. So, but most importantly, is this our first introduction to Abram. We're going to spend the next several class periods talking about him. He's likely not the oldest in this list. He is mentioned first of those three sons of Terah. I won't go into all the details of why they don't think he's the oldest, but he is kind of the famous one. Right? He's the one that everybody knows about. He's the father of all living, so he is mentioned first. And then we noted the younger ages of fatherhood there. So this is a genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in his native land in Ur of the Chaldeans. Then Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarah was barren, and she had no child. So we see a couple of characters introduced to us here in those few verses that are also going to be very important in the life of Abram. Who might be the first one? Right? Okay, that's his wife, right? We already find out that she's barren. Now she has no child. Of course, we'll understand how that becomes significant a little bit later on. What about a little bit farther back in those verses? Exactly. We see Abram and Lot spend a whole lot of time together. They get to choose. They make Abram lets Lot choose which of the two lands that he wants, and he chooses Sodom and Gomorrah, unfortunately, and we know what all happens there. But as Ms. Paula pointed out, that's because his father Haran died, so Abram took him on to take care of him. I don't know why we, at this point, we already have so many duplicated names. Not that many people in the world, but it makes it very confusing sometimes. So there's a place called Haran and a man called Haran. The way I always remember it is Haran never made it to Haran because he died in Ur before they got started on the trip. And then there's a couple other duplications in there too, but it can be hard to keep it straight sometimes. But anyway, yeah, so we're introduced to Sarah and Lot as well. All right, so I don't know how much time we got. Yeah, we'll finish up here. Okay, so how does Abram's life begin? How are we introduced to him in the Old Testament? What's the first thing that Abram does? That's to leave his home country, right? To leave where he's brought up and go to the place that God will show him. And Mr. Cook will talk more about that on Wednesday night when he receives those promises. But he gets started on the journey here in chapter 11. Well, I got behind a slide here. So, and Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and they went out with them from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan. And they came to Haran and dwelt there. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So I think I have a little map for you. Yeah. So Abram originally lived down there in Ur, over there on the right part of your screen, just to kind of give you some benchmark. That's the Mediterranean Sea over on the left side. Hope you can see that okay. So it says there, which verse is that? That he's already knows that he's on his way to Canaan. Yeah, verse 31. From Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan. So that's already a significant place. They already seem to know that that's the direction that they're going to be heading. But they kind of head towards the north a little bit more. If they're going straight to Canaan, you'd think they'd kind of cut straight across. But they go up to Haran. I'm not 100% sure why God led them in that direction. But anyway, that's the path that they took. Okay, you know what? You're probably right. You are 100% right. That may be the case. Thank you. I should have looked at my map a little bit more clearly. I should have picked out a little bit better map. That one didn't give me a whole lot of detail. Yeah, that's true too. That's another possibility up through Mesopotamia there, the two rivers together. Very good. Is that one more time? Sorry. Right. And water the flocks, things like that along the way too. Good. All right. Very good. All right. So we've got just a few minutes left. Just kind of wrap everything up. I know the genealogy is always a tough time, but just do want to see how God filled the earth after the flood, right? Does everybody kind of see how all these different nations came to be? I know I've definitely learned a lot looking through chapter 10, especially about where all these nations originated, how they got where they were, especially by the way Noah's three sons divided and how they ended up in those areas. We, of course, know that we don't want to be like the children at the Tower of Babel. We decide to do things our way, just like Adam and Eve did. We decide that we can build a name for ourselves. We can build some status without God. And that's exactly what they tried to do, and God put a stop to that very quickly. And He'll do that for us as well. We may think we have it together, think we're going to accomplish something in this world, but God has a way of showing us consistently that His will is what's going to reign through. And then just we saw how God's plan through Abraham begins just a little bit there. I think that's about all I've got this morning. Does anybody have any things to point out as we finish up? Yeah, and I'm not sure 100% how literal that was, you know, whether he physically came, you know, but your point's interesting. Very good. All right, for Sunday, it's chapter 12, I believe. That'll be, or Wednesday, I'm sorry, with Brother Cook. I guess I'll let y'all out a little bit early this morning, let y'all choose your seat as he likes to do. So, thank y'all. Thank you.